This recording is part of the Northern California Tape Library about alcoholism and was recorded at the Central California Fellowship monthly speaker meeting held at the Labor Temple, Sacramento, California, on March the 11th, 1967. The speaker, Clancy Emmisland of Los Angeles, California.
My name is Clancy Emmisland, and I'm an alcoholic. Is there any members of the press here? It's okay with me. You can't spell Emmisland. I have, this is kind of a unique situation I find myself in. I have appeared before a number of judges in my day. This is the first time I ever appeared after one. I was always the first speaker before. Not guilty, Your Honor. And this is also one of the few times in which I've ever been called upon to talk in which the speaker that was introduced was somebody else. Casey the cop. I wish I were him. I'll tell him when I'll see him in a meeting Tuesday night and I'll push him off the end of the bench. Get out, fool. It's you old timers that are spoiling the program. But I'm happy to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober, because I haven't always been. And it's conceivable that I may not be again someday, and that's kind of a kick in the head to remember that. But I have seen people whose quantity of sobriety is longer than I have had, by far, who have gradually edged themselves back out the door, little by little, as they got more and more blasé and jaded about the rather commonplace characteristics of AA that became more commonplace each year. And I have seen people whose quality of sobriety, as best I can judge, is better than mine, who have edged themselves back out the door. And incidentally, I might say, not out the door to get drunk, but just out the door. Sometimes they don't get drunk for months, sometimes for a year or two. And when they go, sometimes the people that are at the meeting don't even remember them because so many people have come in since they stopped going to meetings. But they serve one good purpose. Whenever such a person as this gets drunk, it flushes out of a lot of the other old-timers out of the woodwork, and you see them back at meetings for a while. Until they ease back out the door again. I certainly am not putting down old-timers because I hope I'm on my way to being one. I don't have all the characteristics yet of a true old-timer. The two characteristics I need still to develop are great temples and hemorrhoids. Gray temples, as you know, give you a look of distinguished wisdom, and hemorrhoids give you the proper look of grave concern. That's a terrible thing to say. But I know that it can happen to me. It happened to the man who taught me about sobriety. I saw it happen to him. He taught me, his last great lesson to me was dying drunk after many years of sobriety. And it didn't get me drunk. It made me stay sober a little bit harder. I've watched people who came in ahead of me work out the door. I've watched my contemporaries work out the door. I've watched people who come in after me work out the door. And the one thing I want to be wary of is ever getting into that state of somnolence or apathy, where I think it now no longer can happen to me. I now have learned my lesson. And if I ever get in trouble again, boy, I'll be back at the meetings. Because by the time I need to get back to the meetings, I've lost the connection that allows me to get back to the meetings, or to get back into contact with people, or to get back in contact with the world. I did not have what is commonly regarded, I suppose, as the classic AA success story. I was in and out of AA for 9 years before I stayed sober, which is not the way it should work. Many times you hear the classic stories of people who say, I went to jail and I went to the hospitals and then I came to AA. I came to AA and then I went to jail 32 times. And after 7 years around AA, I found myself in Texas. And not only in Texas among them nuts, but them nuts figured I was nuttier than they were and put me in the Texas nut house. And that kind of hurts. And after 9 years around AA, when I guarantee you, I knew a great deal about AA, I was just a lost animal on the street. Just a lost animal. I don't mean this in any euphemistic sense. As far as I could judge such a person, I would say a lost animal. And I knew if I had two consecutive thoughts in 1958, one would have been that I knew I was not really an alcoholic. Not really. And I didn't base this on any form of intellectual cynicism, but I based it on 9 years' experience in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous all over the country. I'm a mover. When things get hot, I move. And I've seen a lot of the country because things got hot in a lot of places for me. I have 5 children. Each of them have been born in a different part of the United States. I have lived in a lot of places. I've had a lot of sponsors, fine men. I sometimes wish I hadn't had so many, because on my birthdays every year, I call them all up and say thank you, because I don't know which one of them got the message through to me. But that $42 phone bill is a real drag. I wish I just had one to call up and I'd spend $2 and forget it. But I traveled around a lot, and at the end of 9 years around AA, I suppose the one basic fact I knew about myself is that I was not really an alcoholic. Not really, in much the same manner the judge was talking about tonight. Because of one basic reason, one irrefutable fact. Booze was not my problem like it was for the alcoholic. Booze caused problems for me, no doubt about it, and it gave me a lot of heat. But booze was not my problem. Booze was my answer. It might have been the alcoholic's problem, but to me, I discovered that interminable sobriety was worse than drinking. That means you're a nut. That doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. And they don't have Nuts Anonymous yet. They do, but we call it AA, I discovered later. But I've often thought of someone in 1958 said, "What, on the basis of your time around AA, what does a typical AA speaker talk about?" I would have, that was the mental image I had of all those meetings in Texas and Minnesota and Wisconsin, Illinois and San Francisco and Dallas and El Paso and Rockford and Beloit and Milwaukee and all the cities I'd live. It seemed like every time I looked up, there was some rosy-cheeked old fool exuding good cheer at the podium. And I was saying, "Friends, I drank around the clock, day and night, for 45 years. And then one day I walked through that door, and the desire to drink left me instantly. I now have $5 million with me. 6 cars. 3 different families have come back to me. And I owe it all to one thing. I keep the plug in the jug." And I always envied these people, but I never identified with them. Now, let me say this. I don't know if I ever heard that talk or anybody say anything like it. But in my mind, that just seemed to be the amalgam of all the AA meetings I'd ever gone to. Just a bunch of jolly old fools comparing their bank balances. It just seemed like true alcoholics, when they came to AA, maybe it was just like coming home from the ranch or something. You know, just you walk in the door and stand back so the rewards don't hit you as they start falling. Stories such as, "I was 3 months behind in my rent. And I called AA, and I went to an AA meeting that night. And the next day in the mail was a check that covered that 3 months' rent." I did that once, and I looked at my mailbox the next day. There was an eviction notice. No checks. No magic. Whatever it was happening to them didn't happen to me. I used to hear people say, and I still do sometimes, when I was sober, I was a wonderful guy. When I was drunk, I was terrible. But when I was sober, everybody told me how wonderful I was. Never happened to me. When I was sober, people used to say, for Christ's sake, why don't you have a couple of drinks and relax? Now, don't get drunk, but just, you know. When I stopped drinking, it seemed like I was like people who stopped smoking. You know, you don't get better for a long time. You can always spot a person who's just stopped smoking by the way their nostrils twitch when you light up. You know. I want to tell all you friends out there who are fighting the battle of cigarettes, good luck. But I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I would have given anything to know what I was, but I wasn't an alcoholic. I had spent several thousand dollars on voluntary psychiatry to find what was wrong with me. I had tried a number of therapies. At one time, I tried AA and psychiatry, and it wasn't enough. Eventually, I drank and ran. In another town, I tried Alcoholics Anonymous, plus medications, medically prescribed, taken as prescribed. I had medication to pull me down when I was nervous and tight, to pull me down so I wouldn't drink and run. And then I had medications to pull me out of the suicidal depressions I fell into, and I was a terrible depressive. And AA and the medications together weren't enough. I eventually drank and ran. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous and religions, my own, then my wife's, then a series of fringe religions, down to lighting candles on porches with strange-looking people. And that wasn't enough. Then I read philosophy. As I became less employable, I had more time for mental betterment. And I read Nietzsche and Kant and Schopenhauer and Spengler. If you ever want to read something that'll set you up for a suicidal depression, read The Decline of the West by Oswald Spengler. When you get done, you just, that son of a bitch is right. And that wasn't enough, and I cut and run. Nothing was enough. Because I knew I wasn't, whatever my problems were, they weren't like other people. Not real, and I knew it. I could go to an AA meeting, and I could talk about drinking experiences, and everybody would think I was an alcoholic. But deep in my stomach, I knew I wasn't really an alcoholic. Not like the real alcoholics, whose problem was alcohol. I had an additional problem somewhere inside of me. I didn't know what it was. The best way I ever described it, I heard a guy say a few years ago, he said, all my life I had to kind of have the feeling that when I came off the end, or just coming off the end of the assembly line in heaven, and just as I got near the end, somebody said, hey, God, and God said, yeah. And I got by with the last screw, not quite tight, just not bad enough so it rattled all the time, but when the pressure was on, I knew I didn't have a loose screw physically, but I had a loose screw emotionally somewhere inside of me. And that's why I always felt I couldn't really ever compete, because I was a 50-yard dash man of the emotions. I could do the 50-yard dash with anybody. I could start off on a job and work in that first spurt and do wonderfully. And I could go to a new town and start wonderfully. And I could become a father wonderfully. And I could become a husband and wonderfully, and I could be a citizen wonderfully for about 50 yards down the track, that's all. And then I would look for the finish line, and there's no finish line, no tape. And you discover all the rest of the world is running a marathon, 26 miles. Just and you get to where the end of the race should be, and they're all keeping on going, and you can't go any further, so you cut and run, either physically or emotionally or with booze. Now, this isn't alcoholism. Alcoholism is when you drink and you can't handle it. It isn't alcoholism to be a nut. That's kind of a secret fear that builds up inside of guys like me. There's something wrong, and I don't know what it is. And eventually, when it gets frustrating and baffling enough, you try to kill yourself or think about it. I know that other alcoholics haven't ever done it. I know I'm the only one. Well, I used to know that. And when I was committed in Texas in 1956, I was not committed because I was an alcoholic. I was committed because I killed myself in a little garage in El Paso. And when I say killed myself, I guess I did, because they had to start my heart to get me up, to get me to the psych ward, to commit me as a schizoid, suicidal, depressive. Nothing on my commitment paper said alcoholic. It said, in effect, this man is a nut and belongs in a nut house. And I had a terrible time in that Texas nut house. I had a very interesting memory of that recently. In January, I was asked to address a group of doctors and alcoholic counselors on the theory and the counseling of alcoholics and alcoholism. And by a strange, rather quirk of fate, the place I was speaking was the auditorium where 10 years before to the day I had been a patient in that Texas nut house. They brought me in, and I felt like saying, "You rednecks, I'm well, you know." But I had a feeling if I did that, a lariat would come snaking out of the wings and I'd be back to the ward. But what do you do with a guy like this? He knows about AA. I've often thought about that. If that guy named Clancy Emerson, under a different name, came to my door tomorrow and told me that story, I don't know if I would know how to help him, or I wouldn't know how to treat him. Looking at that person from the outside, I don't know where the key is, because you can't tell him anything. He's got a wall of cynicism and resentment built up, combined with hopelessness and fear masquerading under a wall of arrogance. What do you tell such a guy? Keep coming back? He's heard that for 9 years. I wouldn't know how to treat such a guy. I don't know. Maybe I would, but I don't know if I would or not. A lot of people, when they give up on babies, send them to me because they figure I'm as nutty as these babies and maybe I'll have a chance. But I don't recall ever meeting any like that particular style. I'm glad I don't have somebody like me coming to me for help. I'm not sure if I could help him. I wouldn't know how to start. But on the other hand, I remember how it feels like from the inside in that same situation. And you're looking for somebody who will make it clear. You don't care if they identify you as a green Martian, but for God's sakes, help me. Tell me what I am. And there's really not much hope for a guy like that. What is it? What is the magic? Is it AA plus what? AA plus therapy wasn't enough. AA plus religion wasn't enough. AA plus philosophy wasn't enough. AA plus medication wasn't enough. And that's why I always find it kind of an interesting study for myself to find myself standing here in Sacramento or in my home group in West Los Angeles or in Louisville or Saskatchewan or wherever I happen to be standing, and saying that I haven't had a drink now since 1958, and I haven't had a pill, and I haven't smoked any marijuana, and I haven't run away. And I'll tell you the magic secret that brought this about. Alcoholics Anonymous. Not Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with therapy, or Alcoholics Anonymous plus medication, or Alcoholics Anonymous together with philosophy or fringe religions. But just the same old simple crud that I would have bet my life wasn't enough for me 15 years ago, to say nothing of 1958. And that's kind of a mystery to me. But it isn't a mystery much anymore, but it was for some time. Why is it enough for me now when it didn't used to be enough for me? And I suppose the basic reason was I got so desperate that I got driven to a point where I had to do it rather than talk about it, where I had to be driven to taking the actions rather than discussing them and their overtones and their psychological implications. And I guarantee you I did not work AA in my limited, poor way out of any sincere desire. Sometimes that makes me kind of laugh now when I hear people who say, "All we ask of you, newcomer, is honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness." Jesus, if they had that, they wouldn't be coming here. These are not the characteristics of practicing alcoholics. And going into a hall doesn't change it. That is what we are here to find, I suppose. At least that's the people I know are here to find. I don't recall ever seeing anybody come here with honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. I've heard people talk how they came with these sincerity. AA, if you notice, it was always better 6 years ago. As a general rule of thumb, 6 years ago is when people were sincere. 4 to 7, actually, but or maybe 10. That's when AA was really sincere. First time I heard that was in 1949. A guy told me I should have been around in 42 when they were really sincere. 49 have gone to hell by that time. It's all changing, for Christ's sake. I don't know what's going on. You know. When I got sober in 58, it was 54, 53, 52 were the good old days. Now I hear people talk about 60. Back in 60, when Dunn International, they were all pretty sincere, I'll tell you that. Just like it is now, a bunch of easy wayers, but boy, in the old days, I'm going to tell you a secret. It wasn't any more sincere that I could tell in 49 than it was in 55 or 58 or 60 or today. The program hasn't changed. The people have. Looking back, and I see it in myself, that's how I know. I see things differently now when I forget to check my reactions. I sometimes tell myself, or I find myself telling people, that I did things in my first year because I wanted sobriety. Baloney. I did things because it just hurt so goddamn bad I had to do them. That's why I didn't have any reasonable alternative. But as the longer I get from that period, the more sincere I become. As I look back, I sometimes tell my babies now that I was more sincere slipping than they are sober. In the old days. Huh. And I never had this brought home so forcefully as I did about a year and a half ago. And the guy that I took to his first meeting in 1960 was getting his fifth birthday cake, and he was talking about how when he came here, he realized he needed sobriety on an all-time basis, so he called AA, and somebody had come to pick him up and took him to a meeting, and he had worked this time, you know. And he really believed it and meant it. And I had to stop and think, isn't this kind of funny? The reason he went to his first meeting, because his wife said she was going to stop supporting him if he didn't. But memory has a tendency to soften those kind of corners. In retrospect, I came here because I was sincere. Hardly anybody ever came here because they were sincere. For one very good reason. There isn't anybody who ever needed AA to get sober. Never. Ever. And that sounds ridiculous because you sometimes hear people who drank around the clock for 20 years and didn't draw a sober breath in 15 years. Now that's alcoholism. But that isn't really alcoholism. That's memory softening the corners. I'll tell you an interesting little medical fact that you may check with your nearest friendly physician or your friendly apothecary the next time you're down getting a prescription to banish emotional pain. The book doesn't mention these. It mentions alcohol. As people have said on their way to Forest Lawn, nobody in the history of the world ever stayed drunk 20 years, or 10 years, or 5 years, or 1 year, or 6 months, or 3 months. It would require laboratory conditions for a human body to survive 3 months of constant intoxication. The body cannot withstand constant intoxication. Everybody gets sober again and again and again and again. Whether they go to AA or don't go to AA. Whether they get the word or they don't get the word. And if all of us tonight, based on my inspiring talk, should go out and have a mass slip immediately following this meeting, we will all get sober again and again and again as long as we survive. Despite what used to crop in my mind that AA was a place to get sober, and I thought this after many years around AA, nobody has ever needed AA to get sober, it turns out. When I was sober, survived long enough to find out the medical facets of alcoholism. That's kind of an interesting eye-opener to me. And I checked it later, and it turned out to be true when I was working for a medical corporation. But the human body can't remain intoxicated. The human body fights for survival. No matter what my mind is doing, the human body fights for survival. There is no problem in getting the alcoholic sober. Sometimes it seems as though the only way you can get sober is via a sanitarium or a jail. But I'll guarantee you, if you can't afford a sanitarium and you don't get arrested, you'll get sober under your bed. Barking like a fox. Just as sober as you'll get in the most luxurious sanitarium in the world. It won't be as much fun. When I was a high-bottom drunk fairly early in my career, I used to go to sanitaria. And there's something to be said about being in pain instead of shaking, saying, "Nurse." I've learned my lesson, nurse. That's better than laying in the back seat of your car, throwing up on yourself. But this theory is the same. Your body fights to get sober when it gets to a dangerous point. The body fights for survival against alcohol. Most of it does. Part of it seems to crave it, but most of it, when it gets threatened, fights it off. Just the body, as the same way the body fights off anything that threatens it, like it fights off disease. If you get an infection in your arm, you really don't have to stop and think, now what'll I do, what'll my body do about this infection? I think I'll dispatch some white corpuscles from my right leg, and maybe I'll reroute. No, that would, hell, that wouldn't work. Let's see. Fortunately, your body takes care of such things. It seals off foreign objects. It reroutes blood around them. It brings corpuscles to fight it. It really goes to work, and you can not even know you've been hurt, you know. I'll be damned. You know. Now, the body does the same thing with anything that threatens it, except one major thing it doesn't. And so we're more fortunate than the people who have this. There's only one thing that threatens the body does not recognize. You know what that is? Cancer. That's what makes cancer deadly. That's the only thing the body doesn't recognize. The body not only doesn't fight against it, but brings food from other parts of the body to feed it. To commit suicide. The body commits suicide with cancer, but not with alcoholism. Your body will get you sober every time when you get it threatened, as long as you survive. It has a number of techniques. One very common technique, of course, that everyone here has seen in action, but never identified necessarily as a body-saving technique. Is there anybody here who has... The body has a tendency to throw off toxic substances that threaten it. Is there anybody here who raised their hand tonight who has not knelt at Vespers at 6 in the morning on the cold tile and watched their body throw off a few toxic substances? It sounds kind of vulgar, but it isn't vulgar. It's the body fighting for survival. That's all it is. It's the body fighting for survival the same way it sends white corpuscles to attack a disease in my arm. There's a toxic substance that is interfering with its action. When it gets bad enough, it tries to throw it off. Some days, when you're really sick, it uses every aperture available, and then you're in trouble. I think that's the start of the old phrase, "I just didn't know which way to turn this morning." It sounds bad, but all it is the body in action fighting to preserve its life. It has still another technique that we laugh about, but is a physical miracle. As the alcohol level in the blood rises, it affects areas of the brain one by one. It starts off with speech. That's how you can tell when a guy's had a couple drinks when he calls you, much to his chagrin. "You've been drinking." "No, I haven't. For Christ, I haven't." "You know." "Yes, you have." And then it moves to other areas, controlling balance. Not that it makes you fall down right away, but you know, you just get a little... And hearing. Physically, you can be charted on a map. The amount of alcohol in the blood, what part of the brain it is affecting. Up through sight, see a lot of jokes about guys drunk seeing double. That's nothing funny or magic. All it means, it's got to that part of the brain that controls sight, and it's thrown off the ability to focus a little bit. So instead of going together, it goes just a little bit off, and you see two different images coming in. And then a little while later, it gets to a level where the brain, the body, physically feels itself threatened, and it drops an iron curtain so that you cannot take any more alcohol in. Now, we call that passing out, and we laugh, "Boy, I passed out." That's the body saving your life, because the next area is breathing, and if it gets there, you die. That isn't funny, because that's what makes little kids die who drink a fifth on a dare. Because by the time their body passes them out, it's already in their system and it keeps rising until it gets their breathing and knocks out their breathing, just the same way it knocks out their sight and speech. Very physical. Alcohol works on the body physically. And eventually the body rebels and fights back and makes you get sober. Again and again and again. Now, there's nothing here that's very deadly. Nothing deadly here at all. Your body's going to get sober. And eventually you've got to identify what's causing it. There's nothing deadly. It doesn't seem to be an alcohol. It's a very slow death. Many years, most often. And it's not at all like the allergies. Because you know what alcoholism really is. You know, you ask somebody what an alcoholism is, and everybody knows the answer to that. It's just like reciting the Hail Mary real fast. Alcoholism is an obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. What does that mean? That means I've got to get going now. So long. Here. That means you've got something wrong with your head, and your body craves alcohol. Now, shove off, will you? Don't be a troublemaker, newcomer. Utilize, don't analyze. That is not always a satisfactory answer. It's the correct answer, but it's not always satisfactory to smart alecks like me and others. They say, I've got an allergy of the body. I don't have an allergy of the body. Secretly, don't you really secretly know you don't really have an allergy? Just between you and I, you know that, don't you? They do, maybe, but not us. Everybody secretly knows that for a while after they come to AA. Then if you're lucky and survive long enough, you maybe run across that statement the guy that named it an allergy said. He said, at the time, for want of a better word, we described it as an allergy of the body because it was a functional disorder closely resembling and operating in the same manner as an allergy. And a functional disorder, very simply speaking, is this. It means that your body is sensitive to something and it doesn't affect your body at all before or after taking it. It's only when your body's exposed to it. For instance, each of us in this room could be terribly allergic to Lapland apples, for instance, but we'd never know it unless we got to Lapland and said, oh, there's an apple. But before and after eating that apple, it wouldn't affect us. Alcohol is the least dangerous of all the functional disorders. It is the least dangerous. It isn't half as dangerous as, for instance, a penicillin allergy. Now, there's a deadly allergy. By the time you got it, by the time you discover you got it, you're already sick. And they give you, here, take some penicillin. And sometimes you die just from the medicine. That's a pretty hard way to learn. You know, one time out, your first, that is kind of a hard way to learn. There are some allergies that, for instance, people inhale the same substance as you and I inhale, but in them, their allergy is such that it tightens up their throat, seals it off, and they strangle unless someone is around with a tube to jam down their throat. Now, there is a deadly allergy. Alcohol is a relatively non-deadly allergy. Very easy. You can drink it. Your body gets rid of it when it gets dangerous. And the body somehow seems to require more, but when it gets too bad, it stops its intake and expels it. Now, there's nothing deadly here. Now, the deadly allergies are the ones to be afraid of, obviously, because alcohol isn't really that bad. But isn't it funny? Alcohol is the third greatest killer in American medicine. And according to figures released last summer by the American Medical Association, from combined with tranquilizers, now has become the number one killer in the United States. It's the second cause of insanity. Not insanity from worrying, physical cause of insanity. It ranks second just behind syphilis. And alcoholic insanity is induced exactly the same way that syphilitic insanity, a gradual destruction of brain cells from too high a level of alcohol in the blood that gradually dries out areas of the brain. When you go insane from alcoholism, you don't ever worry again. You become a vegetable. It's funny to talk about, but it's not funny to see them because they've lost the power to think, and they're just like, their minds, their brains are destroyed, physically. And you don't worry about anything anymore. But you don't even know you're not worrying, so it isn't any consolation. But it's a frightful thing. Now, This takes a lot of drinking. This takes a lot of booze in the blood over a long period of time. You'd think anybody would have learned their lesson, and especially when your body keeps sobering you up. Despite what your allergy or sensitivity is, this functional disorder that makes you react to alcohol, eventually you know that you're going to get sober, and eventually, certainly, you will profit from what has happened to you. Everybody knows that. And yet alcoholism is such a deadly disease because of one thing that most patients and most people who treat the patients and most people who write about the treatments often forget. And that is merely that the other half of alcoholism is what makes it deadly. Not that you can't keep the patient sober, but that the conflicts of reality ensure that he will always begin to drink again. The curse of alcoholism is sobriety. Everybody gets sober, and nobody stays sober indefinitely. And that's what makes it deadly. It isn't getting sober. And yet sometimes you and I might think, well, I'm sober. Why aren't things better? I've been sober now for X weeks or months, and it doesn't work. I might as well be dead or drunk, because I'm not really an alcoholic. If I were an alcoholic, these things would have come with sobriety, and they did not. But why should they come with sobriety? You've been sober before. They didn't come then. Why should they come now? They'll come. You'll feel better for a while if you go to meetings and you read the book and you talk to the people. But sooner or later, the meetings and the people and the book called Alcoholics Anonymous are not enough. And we see it every week and every month and every year in Alcoholics Anonymous. People who have found the answer suddenly lose the answer. And Alcoholics Anonymous is no longer enough. And they drink, or they go through terrible depression, or sometimes they kill themselves after just a few short drinking patterns. A friend of mine, a nice little lady, did that last year, early last year. She'd been sober, and she just couldn't identify because she didn't feel as comfortable as the others, and she'd never been in jail, and she'd never been in a nut house. And she knew she was an alcoholic, and she had one bottle of vodka, and then she took a cab to the Miramar Hotel in Santa Monica and jumped 11 floors to the ground. Now, I suppose that is kind of a frightful thing, but that isn't the most frightening thing about that at all. I read something in the Santa Monica Outlook from an eyewitness that made me identify with her. The most horrible thing that I can think of. This little lady gets up on the bed, takes an elevator up to 11th floor, walks to the edge, takes off her glasses and takes off her watch and sets them down, and jumps. Now, there's nothing really so frightening as someone committing suicide. Except that in most everything I've ever done of that nature, I don't mean jumping off a building, but any violent action, sometimes there's a change of heart. And evidently she had a change of heart, because about halfway down she suddenly started to scream. She changed her mind and she screamed the last five floors into the sidewalk. Now I identify with that, because that's the story of my life. Can't even do that right. Just get away. And I know that feeling, and I'm sure most everybody in this room knows that feeling. And what are you going to do about it? You go to the meetings till finally you can't stand to hear Chapter 5 anymore. And you know all the phonies there. And you read the book, and you read it, and it's full of nice little things, and you read those steps that are enough to make you leap into the air and bark like a fox. 12 things designed for little old ladies in white tennis shoes on their way to Vespers. Turn it over to God. Make amends. Tell everybody what a dirty, rotten thing you are. But you and I secretly know you can't use those kind of things in your business. Because the law out there on that street, baby, is get them before they get you. I don't mind going to AA meetings and talking about the steps, but make amends out there? They'd think I was weak. And people have a lot of difficulties because there's one thing that they don't seem to be able to do anything about, and that is life. It's kind of an interesting thing, the obsession of the mind. I don't know if I ever thought about it a great deal, but I have five kids in various stages of growth. And you watch five kids in action, and you've watched about as many kids as you want to watch for a while. But they range from 17 to 2. There was a 6-year absence while we were separated. There was a 6-year absence while we were separated. It's a funny thing about babies. You ever notice that about babies? When they're born, they are the masters of their environment. Anything baby does is just peachy. Mothers have that radar that can hear. I can't after all this time, but mothers can tell the difference between identical cries, one meaning wet pants, one meaning I want milk. They sound the same to me, but mother says, "No, no, don't change his pants. He wants his bottle." Shut up. I'm going to change these pants, dry or not. They're going to get changed. But everything baby does, he lives in a protected environment. And psychology and psychiatry describe this period of life in which you are the master of your universe. And when you toddle and pull down a lamp, 5 years from now, you'll get your head cracked. But now, baby pulled down the lamp. Ah, what a, cute baby. Baby threw up on the floor. And the world revolves around you. And that's the story of my life. I've been trying to get it ever since, but it doesn't. But one day, baby goes out in the front yard or someplace, and he makes another little baby whose the world revolves around him. And the conflict of life begins. And from then on, we are all engaged in varying degrees of conflict of how to get my way from a world that wants its way. And how many compromises do I have to make to them before they'll give me what I want? And this is called adjustment, social adjustment to living, accepting things you cannot change, growing up little by little. And every human being in the world has frustrations and conflict. It hurts me to say that because I prefer to think that only we do. But every human being in the world has ups and downs and good days and bad days and days in which the world is full of sunshine and days in which they're just a bunch of dirty, rotten mopes. And when the conflicts get high enough, they hurt. And then in social adjustment, you adjust yourself a little bit and it goes down and up and up. And this is the story of mankind. There are some people whose illness is such, or whose self-obsession is such, that as the conflicts rise, they are unable to cope with them, and they get higher and higher until the emotional pain becomes too intense in the self-involved person. Some of these people go into what is called psychosis, which means that the brain is unable to cope with reality, so it sets up an artificial reality inside the head that makes it understandable. For instance, paranoia is a persecution complex. I may not like what they're doing, but at least when I have a persecution complex, I know why they're doing it. It's no longer baffling. They're trying to kill me, that's all. But there's no question of why they're acting that way anymore. Or they can call it dementia praecox or any one of the varieties of mental illness. Oddly enough, people like us rarely become psychotic in that manner. Because somewhere along the line, people like us have discovered that we are among the chosen few who can readily and effectively resolve conflict by inducing a relatively bland chemical into the body. Booze does something for me that it doesn't do for a lot of people. When things get tough and everything's going to hell, and after a while, it's a little bit better. The best description I ever heard of is about this guy sitting on the Bowery in New York in the cold rain, writing a suicide letter to his dad back on the farm. "Dear Dad, I'm in New York, and the cold rain is, and his feet are in a puddle in the gutter, and just then he feels a thump on his leg, and there's a half-empty bottle of Muscatel. So I might as well go out." He goes back to his letter, "Dear Dad, I'm in New York, and if there's anything you ever need, you let me know." Now, it's kind of hard to bad rap a chemical that'll do that for you. Booze has a tendency to make a certain amount of social adjustment for me, and for most human beings in the world to a limited degree. However, a small percentage of this drinking population has a tendency to find that it does more for them than it does for other people. And little by little, they come to depend, without even knowing it, on this substance to take care of conflict when it gets too high. And in so doing, they lose their practice at making the adjustments that other people are making, so they become slightly more dependent on it next time, which makes them a little less practiced at making the adjustment over a period of time, which makes them a little more dependent on it next time. And it's a snowball. So by the time a guy needs help, he can't afford to go look for it. Because you know that drinking isn't your problem. Drinking is your answer. They're my problem. You tricked me into marriage. You said you were wonderful and sweet. You're an old bat is what you are. Or other sad things. The only girl I've ever loved keeps going back to her husband and leaving me alone. Terrible. Or that cruddy boss I work for. So you develop quite a psychology. Sure, booze is hurting me. I've got to cut down. But very few people really want to ever completely quit drinking altogether for all time. Because they've been sober. They'd like to find a way to control it. And it's kind of scary when the doctor says, you've got to stop drinking, you're going to die. And sometimes it's an odd thing. The faster and higher the conflict, the quicker I drink, oftentimes, as an alcoholic. In other words, when people lecture me on what I'm doing, what my drinking is doing to my family, it sometimes can make me feel so bad that I have to go drink to forget it, to resolve that conflict. I remember how baffled I was in 1950, when one morning my father came down to the jail cell, which I was in my hometown, that was just before I left that town for good, and he said, I've tried to help you. My father's a very Christian gentleman and teacher and a nice man. And I've tried to help you, and you're my only child, and I've tried everything I can, but this is the end. I thought, what now? I got arrested. What's that? He says, last night, while you were in this jail, I was looking for you to tell you that your little boy was sick. And this morning, I'm here to tell you that he died last night, and it's your fault. And I don't ever want to talk to you again as long as I live. And when I got out of that jail, it was just a minor beef. I took a vow that any time I ever went by a jail cell for the rest of, or went by a bar for the rest of my life, I'd see my son John's face on it. I cried with sincerity. And 30 days later, I was in Milwaukee working, and I was drunk and lost the job. I couldn't understand why. I didn't know that the very guilt and effort of trying to make up for what I had done raised the conflicts high enough so that I had to drink to resolve it. The same thing our book describes. No matter how smart you are, or how much you've been around, or how hip you are, or how much you can quote, there seems to come a time at which there is no defense against the first drink. What you don't know is that it's your mind battling for survival against reality must have conflict resolved in much the same manner that your body battling against alcohol will force you sober. The pattern of alcoholism is not a guy in a long black coat on Skid Row drinking and starting at 15 and becoming a full top notcher by the time he's 70. Alcoholism is, as the judge described, all strata of society. And it's measured not by whether or not you stayed drunk 20 years, but you drink until eventually you drink to sufficient excess for your body to thrust you into sobriety. It may take a long time. In fact, that's one of the sad things about alcoholism. Sometimes you can control it. And you know that you're not an alcoholic then, because the first drink is what does it. You ever have that test? I noticed the guy put some water. This is water. But that wonderful test I've given myself many times. I wonder if I'm really an alcoholic. No craving. Can't fight City Hall. But nowhere does it say the first drink of alcohol makes you get like Dr. Jekyll turning into Mr. Hyde. That is not medically described at all. It says this. When the alcoholic begins to drink, the first drink means that he will eventually drink to excess. It may take 2 hours, it may take 10 months, it may take a year. But he will eventually go, and they have yet to find the first case in medical study in which this has not happened. Everyone that raised their hand here tonight is familiar with that pattern, because there isn't anybody who ever did anything else. Just stop and think. If there was anybody here who had not eventually drunk to excess every time, they would not be here. They would still be in the middle of that one pattern in which they were able to control it. That you eventually drink to excess, and then your body thrusts you sober, and then your mind can't stand sobriety indefinitely, and you eventually thrust into drinking. And what makes alcoholism deadly is not drinking alcohol per se. It's boom, boom, boom. Sometimes it's 2 days drunk and 10 months sober. Sometimes it's 2 days sober and 2 weeks drunk and a day sober. But the pattern of alcoholism is what's deadly, which is all kind of dreary, except for one thing. This is why the American Medical Association, again, for instance, estimates that a majority of people who die from alcoholism never really believed they had it. That a majority of people who died from alcoholism have never been institutionalized, either in a jail or a hospital, because what they had did not fit their preconception of alcoholism. And when I slashed my wrist and took carbon monoxide in Texas, I did it because I did not have what I knew alcoholism really was. I knew I was nutty. Now, there is no way that is yet discovered by which people like us will drink without eventually drinking to excess. Every year or two, there's a new therapy. Dr. Kane had one a couple years ago. Maybe you read about it, the recovered alcoholic. I know Dr. Kane fairly well. He's a 10-year slipper in the Knickerbocker group. And he better find a way to recover, because he sure as hell ain't going to do it any other way. But he was on a TV station I was working for in Hollywood a couple years ago, and he was lecturing. And he was describing the lectures. He said, "Clancy, I tell you, I've got 5 recovered alcoholics, and I make the 6, but I won't count me. I have 5 recovered alcoholics who are drinking sociably." And his book sold well, and he wrote an article in Harper's, AA Culture Cure. He wrote an article in the Post. And he's done a lot of lecturing. But you want to know something? He hasn't lectured for about a year now. He's had to cancel some of his lectures. One of his recovered alcoholics, when he eventually drank to excess, as he had to do medically, was so upset he stopped by and knocked all Dr. Kane's teeth out. Dr. Kane is undergoing extensive dental surgery in New Jersey, or was. But if you can hold out, he may come out and teach you how to drink socially next year. He can't do it for a while. I remember 1958 when the answer at UCLA to social drinking was LSD, when it was in its experimental stages. LSD will allow you to discover in your psyche the reason what makes you drink compulsively. And all the test cases they used were alcoholics from AA who didn't think AA was enough. Not one of them are sober, and 9 of the 11 are dead. Wonderful. But if I'd have been a little weller, they'd have used me and I'd have been dead. But I wasn't well enough yet. I did not have a rapid recovery from alcoholism and AA. But I'll tell you, I discovered something. I have come to believe this. I have come to believe that I'm an alcoholic. And I came to believe that early in my sobriety, because someone pointed out to me what alcoholism was and proved it to me. It is not a mysterious thing. It's not a magic thing. It's a person who cannot stay drunk and a person who cannot stay sober, but who must always leave sobriety to drink, to get away, to run, until the drinking begins to interfere with their life, and still they must continue to do it, no matter what it does to them. Now, what do you do with such a case? Nothing. Very baffling. Very baffling. What do you do with such a guy? You get him straightened out, you buy him some clothes, you get him a job, you put him back there in the world, And the next thing you know, that sneak is drunk. Ungrateful pup. I gave him a good job. Boy, he's got a lot of decisions to make and phones ringing, and it's wonderful. He's got his family back, demanding things in his life. Ungrateful punks. Baffling. Wives call up. I don't know what's happened to George. George has done so well. He's been sober 6 months. Got his job back. Got everything going good. We bought a new home. He's got a new car. Everything is wonderful. We got payments to make. We certainly need him on that job every day. And he's drunk. And I identify with that. There is a 50-yard dash man who just ran out of space. All of a sudden, the walls come in, baby, and there's no way out. So what do you do in such a situation? Not much. It's frightening. It's terrible. That's why AA is kind of a graphic situation. Some years have gone by since I've been offended at what someone has said at a podium, if I believe they're being honest. Because this isn't like the Rotary Club where I can afford to be bored and drop my membership. This is not like the Eastern Star Hadassah. This is not Kiwanis. This is not the Ad Club of Los Angeles. I belong to the Public Relations Society of America. If I want to quit that, I'll quit it. But I can't afford to do that here. Because my life depends on something here. What is it? Teaching me how to stop drinking? No. I knew how to stop drinking long before I came to AA. In fact, that's one of the curses of alcoholism, I really believe. You can't stay drunk. If you could stay drunk, we'd have a smaller membership. You'd have a different speaker, I'll tell you that. It's that damn sobering up all the time and coming back to your loved ones and hearing about things. Well, you've really done it this time. My mother was right about you. Surprising anybody ever survives to get to Al-Anon. But you gotta keep coming back, and then you gotta run, then you gotta come back, then you gotta run, then you gotta come back. Deadly, deadly. Now, what can be done? It is obvious nothing can be done in the field of drinking, at least up till tonight, to the best of my knowledge. So it must be that something must be done in the field of sobriety. It begins to make you stop and think by just sheer deduction that maybe the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to get sober, but rather that getting sober is merely the doorway to Alcoholics Anonymous, in which you come in and do something that science says cannot be done. Take an obsessive personality, which has become psychically maladjusted to dealing with conflict in reality, and find that personality indefinitely dealing with reality. That requires something that can be put simply, but it's in the way I like to hear it. It means like you got to learn how to live. I'm too hip for that kind of jazz, baby. I've been around. What do you mean, learn how to live? I can hustle you in three languages. What do you mean, learn how to live? Yo soy el maestro de los locos. I don't have to learn how to live. Not the king of the Juarez jail doesn't. And yet, that's what it requires. It isn't going out there and making up for lost time. Because the problem that kills you and I is the street, the world, the reality. And that's why it doesn't make any difference after a while how many meetings you go to, or how many times you read the book, or how many times you talk to people. Unless you take some of this material and gradually change your approach after the meeting ends. Alcoholics Anonymous does not meet here in this hall from 8 till 10. There is a meeting of AA here, but Alcoholics Anonymous begins at 10:01, right out there on that street. That's where I must change or drink. And it doesn't make any difference if I'm the most spiritual, psalm-singing member of my group, or I have came in the nicest car, or sat with the most jaded look during that wretched speaker. sooner or later, unless I change the pattern out there, I am going to drink alcohol. And that is as scientifically chartable as what alcohol does to me after I start drinking it. And it doesn't make any difference what you think, or your sister-in-law thinks, or your family doctor thinks, or your mother thinks, or your children think. The reason we are here is because reality has become so untenable. We were driven into dependency, physical and psychological, on a chemical that made it tolerable, and now the chemical is too tough for it. Now what do? You stop drinking? Yeah. But what do you do when the world out there hasn't changed? It's just like coming to a cathedral and claiming sanctuary, but after 30 days, baby, you have to go back out there, and there's all the king's men waiting for you. Here he comes now, Clyde. And it doesn't make any difference how thin you can make your little lips and how spiritual you can look and how often you can go up to sinners and go, "You sinners, you fed hell at the meeting." And it doesn't make any difference how well you can discuss the underlying philosophy, what Bill really meant, if you know enough to read between the lines. But you gradually, if you are fortunate enough to survive, you learn this. That gradually we are forced into working a program of recovery, which everybody knows can't work, is non-applicable to my problem, is kind of ridiculous. And then if you're extremely fortunate and pain and guidance have coincided to force you to do the things for the worst of motives, in retrospect, you begin to realize that this program works, and it works for people like you and me, and that all my beliefs were erroneous, and they could have killed me. I remember when I took my fifth step, I had just finished 6 months of sobriety, and I got a job as a dishwasher at the Gaiety Delicatessen. I was not riding a material side of the program very well. I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot for the first 11 months of my sobriety. And I got this job as a dishwasher, and I thought, isn't this wonderful? An outstanding and creative writer who has worked in some of the top agencies, the newspapers in the world, is so sincere and spiritual in his sobriety, washing the dishes. And I was doing it because I was hungry is why I was doing it. But the mind rationalizes well. And I worked there 4 days, and I was so overcome by my magnificence, I could hardly bear it. Then the fourth day, I got fired. And I went up to this guy and said, "You can't fire me! I'm going to AA meetings every night. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm trying to lead a better life, and I'm trying to find a way to go so I can support my family in Texas." And he says, "Jesus, kid, I don't know about all that. You just don't wash enough goddamn dishes. That's all. You know, that's all." That, to me, in retrospect, sometime later, I realized was the best lesson I ever heard about AA. But AA is not to teach you to spiritually preen while you do the dishes. It's to teach you to emotionally and spiritually be able to do enough dishes to hold a job. Out there. To live out there. But I didn't really recognize this at the time, and I took it like a man. I went off to kill myself. And I was going to do it in the ocean. And I couldn't get to the ocean. I called up a guy, and he cursed me. And over a long period of time, a long conversation, I only had 15 cents, and I used a dime but to call him. But he told me, I said, "What do I do?" He says, "Have you ever taken an inventory?" And I says, "Have you ever?" And I forgot what it was I asked him, but it was something strange. I was hungry and sick and desolate and alone and a failure again, and this fool asked me to write an inventory and remind myself of even further degradations that I was luckily enough not remembering. But at the end of that conversation, I got so upset that I went back to the AA club and I wrote an inventory. And when I got done writing that inventory, friends, nothing changed. I went to sleep that night in the backseat of an abandoned car, half a day hungrier than I had been, mad, upset. But I had a kind of a feeling good because I had showed that guy taking an inventory didn't work. And it wasn't for 3 months that I could look back and say that was one of the great turning spots in my life, because without knowing it, I didn't even think of it at the time, In 9.5 years around AA, that was the first time I'd actually ever written an inventory. I'd talked about them and discussed them and knew the reasons for them and had taken a catharsis with an analyst, but I had never written an inventory. I hadn't done the things they're talking about. And sometime I was going to kill myself again, that made me take a fifth step. I have never, early in my sobriety, I never did one thing for the right motive. I only did it because it hurt too bad. But it worked just as well as if my motives had been perfect. Because the theory of AA is not, you wait for your motives to be right and then you take the right action. The theory here is, if you're going to wait for your motives to change by themselves, baby, you got a long wait. You begin to change the actions and eventually your motives change along with them. And what makes you take actions? Pain combined with guidance. I'm certainly glad I had a higher power who cursed me and made me do these things. Because he eventually led me to a higher power I could pray to. But I couldn't pray to that higher power when I needed it at first. I had to have a guy say, get going! And I had to have a hand, an arm I could grab onto and admit I was a failure. Because I was so phony, I couldn't be secure enough to admit I was a phony. But I could with him. I am not, perhaps, a good example of AA. But I was a sick man, and I am a sober man. And I guess if I wanted to, I could have laid a nice talk on you tonight about all the nice things in my life, and you'd have all gone home and said, isn't that wonderful? Things are nice. As I say, my family, I didn't see my kids for 6 years. When I left on the plane this afternoon, they were all there kissing me goodbye. The four daughters that I lost forever, plus a new little boy who was born 2 years ago named Clancy Emerson. Isn't that a weird name? My daughters insisted on calling him Clancy Emerson, which was nice. I live in a very comfortable home with a big yard. The backyard this afternoon when I left was full of alcoholics playing miniature golf. And goodbye, Clancy. Your shot, you know. Makes you feel like you're really wanted in your own home. Each of these people I've saved personally. I got a good job. 20 years ago, I was in Fleet City near San Francisco at the Navy Nut House I was in for having a personality disorder with a prognosis of indefinite. 10 years ago, I was in the Texas Nut House with a personality disorder that was so bad I couldn't stay alive. And today my job is I'm a public relations glad hander in California. Isn't that nice? All day long I go out and win people. Hello there, how are you? Have another little drink. Now that isn't in itself as menacing, but it is to me. Can you imagine the high companies hiring me to go out and represent them? When I couldn't even live on the street as a dishwasher? Sober? And I'm not any more sober now than I was then. The only thing is, in between time, evidently, I've had enough pain and guidance to force me to change things on that street. Now, that's all very nice. Family, home, job, cars, certain amount of respect in my profession, certain amount of respect in my block. But there's another side to that, too. I firmly believe that I need Alcoholics Anonymous more tonight than the night I got sober in 1958. Because that world is infinitely more complex in my life now than it was then. Then all I had to do was survive. Now there are days I don't feel like being anybody's daddy. But nobody cares. I'm their daddy and I got to act like a daddy. When the judge was talking about the family situation of the drinker, it made me homesick for last night. There are days I don't feel like an employee. And there are days that the phone rings off the hook and people want things and the bills are coming in and the goddamn car's got a flat tire. My wife said, you got to buy me a dress. And the kid said, you promised me the Girl Scout money this morning. And I sometimes wonder, where that old abandoned car is. I would just go back there and lie down for a couple of days. I got what I prayed for, and now, baby, it's just like being an all-time juggler with 16 balls. I need Alcoholics Anonymous pretty bad tonight. And yet a part of my mind says, you don't need AA, baby. You've got to return to normal living now. More money will cure it. More things. Big house. That's all you need. You don't need all them cruddy meetings and them 12-step calls. When they call in the middle of the night, don't answer it. To hell with them. Not the people who need that. You've helped enough people. They owe you so much now for it. That's part of my mind. When I'm tired or hungry or cross, sometimes it gets a little out of control and I have to... Remember that I'm standing alert and straight tonight, not because I'm basically a good man who unfortunately drank a little bit one time, but because I'm kind of a mixed-up kiddo who fortunately, his mixed-upness took himself out in alcohol, which eventually drove him to eventually having to learn how to live in a relative greater amount of peace out there in the world. I am not a good man. I will not lay this message on you. It took me a long time to come to pray, but I've not failed to pray in many years, but I wouldn't tell you to pray. I wouldn't tell you to worry about meditating. I think the most important thing I can tell you to do is I hope to God that you can find something here, just an arm that you can grab and say, help. And then when they tell you what to do it, no matter what your motives are. To gradually do non-applicable things, because only in retrospect do you realize how applicable they were to what really was wrong. I am not a saint, and I am not a good man, but I am the best Clancy Immerslin that I've ever had to work with in my life. And it's not due to my pluck or grit or insight. It's due to the fact that gradually, superimposed upon me against my will, were a series of principles and actions that I've resisted, and yet when I did them, worked as well as if I had done them out of love and devotion and dedication. Now I do them from habit. It's no problem. But I don't need them so much now, except when I get embroiled in the complexities of rewards. Rewards are a drag sometimes. If I get two more rewards this month, I'm going to cut out. Just cut out. I've had enough rewards for a while now. Just, you know, I'll learn to live where I am. This is a good life. I am glad to be sober. I am no longer in danger of thinking that I am too sick for AA. Now I must spend a few years working against the principle that I am now too well for AA, that I no longer need AA. I have a good many reminders about me to remind me when I start thinking that way. I'm glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. I am glad primarily. It does really, the last analysis, make any difference what you think of me or not, because tomorrow morning I'll be on a plane and I'll be gone. And whether you liked me or were impressed by my message or thought it was abysmal will not change the fact that tomorrow I must make the street as comfortable as I made it today. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It is a program of learning to live sober when scientifically I cannot exist sober, because the conflicts will eventually destroy me. So here I must learn to deal with conflicts, and I can't even afford to use my judgment, because my judgment has driven me here, the misuse of my judgment. I sound a little bit like I'm carried away with AA, perhaps, but I am. And it's not, as I say, because I'm a good man or a good AA. It's because I've been a bad man and a mixed-up man, and I thank God that I was driven through pain and desperation to try it again and to not mix it up with mishmash. And as my life became more complicated in frustration, not to continue seeking more complicated answers, but rather taking the simple answers and applying them instead of talking about them. Because Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you like it or I like it, or whether it appeals to you or appeals to me at the beginning, has more success in dealing with people like you and me than all the other therapies combined. I am glad to be here tonight sober. I am glad most of all that tonight I will walk out into what has become a friendly environment out there. And for this, I can never be grateful enough. Thank you.